So thank you to the organizers, first of all, for giving me a 20-minute time slot to speak today. 2 years ago, I gave a lightning talk here, and I'd given a talk in a China International Art Conference presentation 2 weeks earlier, and I reused the slides for that, and they ended up being 50 pages. So I gave a 50-page lightning talk in 7 minutes. So I'm that guy, if you remember that. I'm going to try to talk a little slower this time. Approximately still the same number of pages, but hopefully we can actually get through them at a more moderate pace this time. So, again, my name is Robert Krasnowski. I go by Rob K, typically. Wonder why. So blame my parents for that one. I work at Avant. We're an online consumer lending company doing unsecured installment loans anywhere between 600 and 750 FICO range. We've been around since 2013. Growing really quickly. We grew from 0 to 1,000 employees over the course of about 2.5 years. Nowadays, we're trying to expand out to different kinds of products, launching a credit card product end of the year. Plan to expand out into Canada and Australia eventually at some point in the upcoming years. So very fast growing company, lots of interesting, exciting technology problems. And my title is Director of Data Engineering, which is actually kind of annoying for recruiters because they all just send me these like ETL scripting positions, and that's not what I do. So it throws off the trail a little bit, but I did hit all the three buzzwords, so that's kind of cool. The place where we're at today is a lot of the stuff that we do involves a lot of analytics, a lot of machine learning, doing a lot of predictive problems, structured supervised learning. And so at the very beginning, it's kind of, all right, so kind of let me start here. I actually look backwards. Okay, so this is kind of the information slide. Feel free to check out this website. It's live as of literally this morning. So this is actually the very first time we're publicly presenting this. Avant is sort of presenting this. It's licensed under MIT. It's a collection of R packages that we're releasing based off of work that we did in 2013 and 2014 that was suitably refactored. So it's all up on GitHub now. And if you want, you can tweet us, hashtag Siberia or something like that. And there's an email if you want to email us with questions. So here's kind of what motivated this. Is at the very beginning, it was just me and my buddy Tong Lu. We joined Avant really early on, and we worked together for about 2 years, almost just the two of us with our chief risk officer, John Sun, trying to solve a bunch of underwriting, modeling-related problems. And we were using R kind of for everything. And we had no idea how to use R, so our initial code base was just a total mess. This was before we knew how to use packages. So kind of after 6 months of that and running into all these tangly obstacles, we realized our problem was just we were treating R the wrong way, because R workflows are typically sort of scripting workflows. You kind of just script it out, and then you're done. You just kind of convince yourself that's all you had to do, and then you move on with your life. And that's kind of a problem. You can split stuff up into packages, which are great, sort of like almost like theorem-proving devices, right? My background is in mathematics, so I think of packages as like nice theorems. You know, they're very nice and abstract. If you want to import some data in a certain format, or if you want to build something like dplyr or ggplot, right? But they kind of fail you when you have a lot of stuff that's constantly changing with a large team, because they enforce a very specific structure, and a lot of times there's lots of constants all over the place, like a .csv file here, a parameter there, right? It's kind of hard to use packages for that workflow. And mostly, test-driven development, I mean, it's built into packages because of testdad, and testdad some more, but test-driven development workflow is pretty difficult with large teams of data scientists. And it's really important to use testing. A lot of software engineers sort of keep emphasizing that. That's like the first thing you should do is like, you're Mr. Miyagi, you know, write your test, and then you actually build the rest of it. And the reason for that is because as the project grows in complexity, like if you're working with one or two people, you all know what you've built. But if you're working with 10 people or 50 people, or if you're like Google, where there's 50,000 people and they all work on the same repository, Google actually had to build their own version control system to make that happen, you want to make sure that nobody breaks someone else's stuff. So it's really important to have that built in when you have large projects. So this is an industry-wide problem. Kind of the canonical example here is the 2014 paper by Google, where they ran into 35 different problems related to sort of messy workflows in machine learning. And some of the stuff is intended to stymie these problems. So kind of the solution we came up with is go back to the roots and think more like a developer. So you want to architect a system. There's kind of these frameworks called like Rails or Django for web development. So this is what developers do. when they're faced with a seemingly insurmountable problem is they write a framework. And that sounds like a sort of scary, messy word, but really all it means is if you have a bunch of packages that are all thematically connected, right, kind of like tidyverse, where it's almost like a framework, right? There's a bunch of packages that all work and mix and match well together. Kind of like the Unix operating system has a bunch of tools like cat, ls. You guys probably use these on a day-to-day basis that all do one job well. But using something like a piping operator, right, you can kind of mix and mesh them together. So Sabir kind of is built on the same idea. It's a framework for building complex projects in R. The modular design unit is called an engine. We'll cover that in a second. And today we're going to release something called the modeling engine, which is intended just to give like a simple example of how to use this kind of stuff in practice. So here's kind of the template I want you to have in your mind. Again, going back to the simplest example, given that oftentimes there's so much emphasis, right, on these big data tools, like Shalar covered earlier, which kind of end up with you tripping all over your own feet. I think it's really mindful to walk before you run. So this is sort of the simplest modeling setup I want you to have in mind is you import some data from a data source. You clean it up so that it's ready for input into a statistical classifier. Then you play with some parameters and you make a model, and then you export your object so you can use it later to validate sets or run in real time. So the modeling engine here is the boss that kind of coordinates everything, and there's four R packages involved here. Mungbits kind of handle the cleaning stuff. Tundra handles the storing the model object for serialization. Director holds the sort of holding together the hierarchical directory structure project together, and then StageRunner is the execution system for actually executing each of these four ovals you see. So here's kind of typically how we started back in 2013, is we would source an R script, right? Very common workflow is you just source your script. But the problem with that is it's very hard to really reuse components, especially if you kind of aren't mindful about, if you have a 1,000-line script, right, and someone points you to line 725 and says, run this. It's kind of annoying, and it's also, as it grows, becomes harder and harder to kind of realize how to make effective use of that. So in Siberia, we kind of replace that with resource, and we actually encourage you to never use source again, simply because it encourages that kind of scripting mentality. So with resource, what you do instead, here you can kind of see we're resourcing something called libadapters S3. So S3 is Amazon's cloud storage, where you can kind of upload files out into the cloud. Here, we're trying to say, give us an object, so kind of R object, that can read and write to and from S3. So the idea in Siberia is everything is a resource. All the resources have to have accompanying tests, and each resource type has its own kind of grammar. So let's pick kind of the simplest task just for illustrative purposes. Let's import some data. So I try to kind of pick a super simple example I could fit onto one slide. You see I'm not really doing much here. This is just so you can kind of get familiar with a little bit of syntax. The green read and write methods, if you were to source this file, nothing really would happen, right? Because you just have two local variables. So if you use resource instead on it, we'll see in a second what happens. There's this other file called config routes that's present in all modeling projects where you basically specify how to read stuff in libadapters and use the adapters controller. So if you call resource on this libadapters S3 guy and then call $write on it, then that allows you to write stuff using this S3 store method. And if you call read, it allows you to pull stuff from S3. Even if you open a new R console, it's on the cloud now, right? So you should be able to read it. The other thing is that you can add tests. So if you put something in test/lib/adapter/S3, doesn't really matter what code is written here. I'm just trying to sort of show you that you can test whatever was written in the earlier slides. And when you run the tests, you can kind of see your nice little green dots, and sometimes you get a smiley face. That's, I think, sadly, 1 every 10 times you get a smiley face. And so going back, how is this stuff put together? Well, libadapters gets matched up to the adapters controller. The adapters controller, again, this isn't what it really looks like in practice. I kind of just simplified it down so you can see it in one slide. Think of an adapter class as being like some S3, S4, R6 class with a read and write method. And then the blue stuff is given by Siberia. It's kind of like a grammar Siberia gives you, input. And then the green stuff, read and write, that comes from our file, from libadapter's S3. And this green thing input, what it's really doing is if you've ever called the source function, there's a second argument you can pass where you actually give it an R environment to source with. And when you source it with that R environment, read and write actually become keys in that environment. So it can actually extract them out and make them available somewhere else. So that's really the magic that's happening under the hood. It's really not magic at all. It's just making use of R package-based functions. So you can kind of think about how you could generalize this to more fancier examples. Here I'm just relying on a different package called S3 MPI for doing the real grunt work. You can unroll that into the actual code that goes into that package. But you can think about reading and writing from a CSV file, from a database, right, from some sort of JSON store. Like any sort of reading and writing, you can kind of abstract into read and write mechanisms with some options. So this abstracted away the storage backend, and the idea is that the lib adapters directory now has one uniform syntax. The adapters controller tells us that all adapters must have a read and a write method, and that's it. So there's no more scripting, there's no more messy stuff. You kind of instantly know everything in libadapters has to feel and look like this. And so that's pretty powerful because it means that whether we're trying to read from S3 and store to S3 with large files, or read from the file system and store to the file system with smaller files, we can use the exact same code. So the premise here is that everything's a resource, kind of like in Unix, everything is a file, right? In Siberia, everything is a resource. Each resource produces a single R object. So this encourages finding common interfaces, and work becomes super reusable, ideally, if you find the right abstractions, instead of being locked away on line 725 of your script. So going back to our sort of prototypical modeling pipeline, you got to import some data, clean it, model it, and export it. So that was one simple example with adapters. If you zoom into what this actually looks like, the high-level model parameterization, there's going to be a file called a model file that is actually going to parameterize these four different stages. And I want to focus on the data stage now, where we actually clean up the data. So each single line in this data stage uses the MungeBiz controller. So this is a different controller with a different grammar that does a totally different thing. So here again, you have sort of green stuff, which is going to be tied to the controller later. Instead of having read and write, we have train and we have predict. So kind of take a look at this. This doesn't do anything useful. It just orders by a certain column. You probably don't really need to do it. I just try to find the shortest munge bit we had in our code base, and this is the one. So. You can kind of see that train and predict are the exact same function, and I'll explain what that means in a second. And you can actually check from the R console by running that code that ordering by the first column is the same as the actual code I've unrolled sort of on the right-hand side of that all dot equal call. But here's a more complicated example. And this is still simple, but I'm trying to show you is that sometimes train and predict are the same, sometimes they're different. This is what Spark calls wide versus narrow transformations and sort of the source of that Google paper. When you're scripting, you don't realize what's a wide and what's a narrow transformation, and that's where all the problems come from. In narrow transformations, you don't need to know anything about the training set. You can just do operations one-on-one. In wide transformations, you need to somehow store some metadata coming from the training set, and every time you retrain your model, the metadata might change. So for example, with mean imputation, you got to store the mean, right? And if you subsample a different population, then the mean for your feature might change. The same thing is true for normalizing z-scores. You got to memorize the mean and standard deviation. And so in this grammar, again, input is provided by Siberia. This is actually a different input. This is a MungeBits input. And then the green stuff is going to get used by the MungeBits controller. So we can check in the R console that we actually impute correctly. Again, this is a super simple example. In the real imputer, it's slightly more complicated, but this is just so it can fit on one slide. So here's sort of a condensed version of the MungeBiz controller, just to kind of show you. Most of the work is done in another package, but it's constructing this MungeBit object with the train and predict method coming directly from that file. A more complicated controller, classifiers, you can do more stuff. It builds a Tundra container, and then does something called deflation. But the point of that is that it allows you to keep the actual syntax at the tip of the iceberg, the model file itself, pretty compact. You just have to say, we're going to use GBM, and we're going to have these many trees, and we're going to use this ADA. And so zooming in on that, that's kind of what it looks like. You can pick your own parameterization. This isn't canonical. You can kind of play around and change things a lot. And here's a complicated one. Don't read this. This is intended to scare you. This is just to show you, like, you can make things as complicated as you want. One problem we kept running into is that we wanted to have helper files so that we wouldn't have that problem where we'd have a 1,000-line file. So if you notice, models/models.r has the same name as its parent directory. We kind of call these idempotent resources. Anytime that an R file is in a directory with the same name, the files around it with a different name are considered helpers, and they're invisible to Siberia. They're only usable by that models.r file. JavaScript, the Node.js community, takes a similar approach. It's to kind of fit in into a language that never meant to become so popular, right? So this is kind of like a solution around that problem of having lots of helpers that are local just to your given resource, is to have idempotent and not idempotent resources. And when your thing gets too complicated, turn it into an idempotent resource by putting it in its own directory with an R file with the same name. So there's other stuff we can do. We can create grammars for modules to sort of tie together a bunch of functions. We can use indicators for constructing things like a formula object that actually, when mixed with a data frame, pulls stuff from an ETL backend, where each of the left-hand side maybe comes from a BI tool like Looker, and the right-hand side comes from data sources like Postgres, et cetera. You can turn your formula into a dynamic formula that's capable of sort of making your data real on demand. Stages for actually specifying what you do with import, data model export, jobs if you want to do stuff like building reports, monitoring checks, and queries. Like, for example, if you want to have a SQL query in R that interpolates a bunch of stuff that comes from your project, you can have a grammar for that. And so what do you actually do with this? Because I only showed you a list, right? So the model file itself is just a list. It parameterizes everything you want to do. To actually breathe life into it and make it do something, well, what better thing than typing run, right? So we have this helper called run. This doesn't actually pollute the R global namespace. It attaches under a different namespace. If you don't know what that means, that's fine. It's a more advanced R thing. But this run thing gets attached to your search path, and it becomes available in the R console. You can type run example. It finds the correct model, runs the model. This is the simplest possible. This is like a hello world model. It doesn't actually do anything. It's just using Iris. And you can call predict on it to get a bunch of predictions. And so that model.predict call takes care of reproducing your feature engineering from scratch, from the raw data, to running all those things you put in data stage, then calling the classifier, and then returning the scores. You can rerun just one of the steps if you want to do debugging. Typically, the suggested workflow here, and the point of all this, is that you can interactively kind of debug your way through the end of data stage, starting with a messy data set, rerunning stuff, and then playing with the before and after, which you see there's aliases here, capital A and capital B, that allow you to kind of debug your munch procedure as you go along until you're happy. You can do test project, one of the exported helpers as well, to kind of run all the tests. We mentioned earlier that everything has to have a test, and if it doesn't, your test suite breaks. So this kind of forces you to be honest with yourself and make sure that no one can push anything to your project without having a nice test to ensure that it's actually doing what it's supposed to be doing. The other big thing is that things can get complicated. Here's a bunch of dependencies that are getting loaded. Each of these are packages. This kind of, under the hood, there's a thing called Lockbox that's managing that stuff and ensuring if you're on two different versions of the project called branches, if you're familiar with version control, different users may be using different versions of different packages, even if you're using hundreds of them, and no one's going to get confused and trip over their feet. Under the hood, it actually stores the packages in a separate directory, and it never interferes with your global library. So if you install Siberia by going to that Siberia.io thing, it's actually going to be installing all these versions of packages in the background without touching your global R setup so that you can't mess it up. Here's kind of how that, what's happening under the hood is there's a file called the log file that actually you can specify all the versions of the packages you want, and that comes with your code base. And so when you open up R, it's going to set up, it's going to clear your entire path of attached libraries and set these guys up for you instead. So currently, we have tens of thousands of commits with this approach, thousands of different branches of development, 35 different people have made code commits, meaning small modular contributions. And so in the future, currently we have two main engines, kind of just for illustration purposes. You can build your own. That's the whole point of this, is if you don't know how to solve your problem, then use the 6-month messy approach And then once you kind of crystallized what you think the abstraction should be, write an engine. So I thought while I was like kind of listening today, so I kind of added this stuff last minute, how would you, for example, do like high frequency trading using Siberia? Well, kind of the craziest idea I had was what you could do is you could define a backtesting engine in Grammar, which is kind of similar to this, but it'd be used for trading backtesting strategies, using it to visualize and test stuff, defining resources to transfile R to VHDL or something if you want to get the optimal performance out of it, and then push it to FPGA arrays and trade in real time, having a separate team maintain the actual R stuff and a separate team of engineers translating your munch bits and whatever else you have into FPGA code. So here's a thank you to all the Avantis. Two of them are here today, Jason, French, and David. If you guys could just clap for them for like 10 seconds, that would be awesome. So a lot of work went into this. We've been working on this for a while. This is just the sort of the tip of the iceberg. Most of the stuff we have internally is obviously specific to our domain. This is all agnostic to our business purpose, which is what allows us to release this under an MIT license so anyone can use it for whatever they want. Depending on the actual thing this is going to get used for, you may wish to kind of customize a little bit, but all that stuff should be in the documentation. So, Siberia.io, go check it out.